Good morning, welcome to Division 7 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. We have one case before us right now, People versus Diaz. I see that counsel are here and ready. I'm sure counsel are familiar with our procedures, but if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. For members of the audience, I'd request that you either turn off or put on some silent mode, any kind of phone that you're carrying so that we're not disrupted during the arguments this morning. One other matter, the court, of course, is aware of a motion that's filed regarding the arguments in this case, both the argument itself and the recording. We have ruled on that motion. I would remind counsel to be circumspect in their remarks today so that we don't go into the matter specifically that counsel is concerned about. We're ready to proceed.
May it please the court, Gregory Lansky, 38515, from Mr. Manuel Diaz. This is a direct appeal from Mr. Diaz's conviction and 216-year sentence in two matters that were consolidated for trial. I'm going to begin with the what the court requested from counsel in regards to supplemental briefing, in regards to choice of counsel issues. And with regards to that, our position is that based upon the December 4th, 2009 transcript, I think it's readily apparent that the court did not follow the proper procedures when disqualifying Mr. Diaz's long-term court-appointed counsel. I think the court performed a number of errors when disqualifying counsel. These errors consisted of not knowing the specific nature of the conflict, the details or the facts of the conflict.
Well, counsel, on that particular issue, though, the record does show that the defendant spoke with ADC off the record about this whole issue. Don't we need to know, or doesn't the court need to know, what was said during that conversation to decide this particular issue?
Well, with regards to that, the reason why the court doesn't need to take that extra step is because the fact is that the court never provided Mr. Diaz with the opportunity to waive the conflict. But the fact that that opportunity was never given, he was never given his opportunity to exercise his constitutional right to choice of counsel. So irregardless of what was stated, if anything was stated by the ADC counsel, I'll submit based upon the record was made by the public defender at the time, that no one really knew what the conflict was about. And I'm sure if you can infer that the ADC counsel most likely didn't know either.
But I guess my point is, why does any of that matter if, say, the defendant preferred to have a different lawyer?
Well, because...
And which he may have expressed to ADC?
Well, that's not what's on the record. What's on the record is that, number one, there was no motion to disqualify counsel before counsel made this record of a conflict. And number two, there's no indication that that was the case. He didn't ask for a new counsel. He didn't seek a new counsel. He didn't make a record for a new counsel. What happened...
Well, actually, he did say that he wanted who I'll refer to as RB to be his lawyer. He said that on the record.
That was after the court did not give him the opportunity to exercise his choice of constitutional. That was after the fact. And because he was not properly advised by the court, he was not advised his right to waive conflict-free counsel. You know, he made that that remark because he wasn't aware of the proper protocol.
But he also said he wasn't happy with the public defender, that his public defender wouldn't communicate with him, he wasn't prepared for the case, he didn't feel he'd been properly represented. And yet you stand here today saying that's the lawyer he wanted.
Well, I think you didn't look in the context of that was stated. What happened was that I think he was really complaining of lack of communication. If the communication was the only issue, then he could have, you know, his court-appointed counsel could have dealt with that. Typically, in these criminal defense cases, there's always been some sort of conflict between the counsel and their attorney because they think they're not doing everything. What counsel usually does is, this is what I'm doing, I'm notifying you what I'm doing, and this is why I think I'm the best counsel going forward. We didn't know that was good enough. You know, the fact that the court disqualified counsel before his court-appointed counsel had that opportunity to explain, hey, I did this investigation, I spoke to these witnesses, this is what I'm doing for your case, this case is now 10 days from trial. I have done all the prior litigation in this case. I know what the rules are. I know how to object in this case. And it's pretty clear from the record that the court-appointed counsel was pretty confident at this time. So the fact that he made these remarks after the fact the court erroneously disqualified his counsel, cannot be used as a basis to deny this claim they were denied of choice of counsel, because again, it's clear the court did not follow the proper procedures.
But Mr. Lansky, you would have thought, I mean, following up on Judge Jones' questions, you would have thought that if the defendant was unhappy with losing the prior counsel, he would have said something at some point, either to his later counsel or the court or at any time to someone.
But the problem was that the court didn't follow the proper procedures. And the thing is that the court did not give him the opportunity to object. So if he wanted to avoid the objection, he was not given the opportunity to do it.
But could he have done it afterwards, I guess? Because, for example, because it's relevant here, there seems to be important that this the PD was the counsel of choice. But how do we know he chose that counsel or wanted that counsel to continue? He could have said that afterwards.
I think there's a presumption, number one, when there's no record of him before the fact, before counsel was disqualified, I think there's a presumption that you know, he's sticking with his counsel 10 days before trial. There's no indication before that fact that that he did not want that counsel. And when the when the court did not give him the opportunity to waive the conflict, he didn't say, I'm not waiving the conflict either. So it goes both ways with regards to that issue. And the reality is the fact that the court didn't advise him, you know, he knew he had the right to waive a conflict-free counsel. Because he was not properly advised of that fact, then he didn't know he had the opportunity to object later on. He thought, hey, this is the procedure, this is what the court is telling me what has to be done, and the court made a ruling, so how can he now not follow what the court said and object later on? And because of this, because of the lack of opportunity, and because of the fact the court abuses discretion and not weighing the proper factors, he was denied his opportunity to exercise his counsel choice. He was not properly advised, the court did not give him the opportunity. And based on that, I think, based on people being minor, I think in 1980s case in Colorado Supreme Court, the case proceeded to trial, and therefore I think his convictions and sentence need to be reversed.
It seems to be your position that the defendant could waive any conflict, no matter what it was. Is that your position?
No, not absolutely not. That is okay. Not my position. I mean, the court has to do weigh the integrity of the judicial process with his right to waive conflict-free counsel, which is buttressed in the Sixth Amendment to the choice of counsel.
All right, but here you have the public defender who won't say specifically what it is, obviously, but says this is not the kind of conflict that's waivable. It's just not.
But how do we know that? I mean, we have to trust every time the counsel goes to court, it's not waivable.
Well, he's an officer of the court, yeah.
But People v. Harlan says you need specific details. You know, you can't just base on conjecture or speculation. The Supreme Court rules on this issue. You need to give details and facts why you have a conflict. Just to walk into court and say, I have a witness conflict, therefore get off the case 10 days before trial, I don't think the Supreme Court sanctioned such a procedure. I don't think that's the proper procedure. I think the court needed to know more detail what this conflict was all about. If there was an issue in regards to competences, you could appoint an independent counsel, you could have done an in-camera proceeding. And the fact is, when the court actually did inquire, wanted more information about this conflict, defense counsel at that time said, I can bring people in from my state office. I can tell you what the conflict, essentially what the conflict is about. But, you know, the court didn't take him up on that opportunity. So the court had the opportunity to even learn more information about this conflict, didn't want to know about the conflict, disqualify counsel without advising those right to waive conflict-free counsel, without giving an opportunity to object. And based on that, I think, I believe that his convictions and sentence should be reversed. If there's no question about that, I'm going to go to the next issue, which I think possibly could be an issue of first impression, is the search of the automobile. In the first case, 09-CR-60. And before we go to the issue of first impression with regards to the Colorado Constitution, Article 2, Section 18, I think before you go to that part, I think you need to first look at the Fifth Amendment Constitution and with regards to Patain and the facts of Mr. Diaz's case. And specifically, in Patain and also in Bradshaw, which applies Patain, is the issue of there's a fact there which is not present in Mr. Diaz's case. And that fact is that both in Bradshaw and Patain, the defendant consented to the search. So the issue in Bradshaw was the voluntariness of the consent. And Patain, the reason why it matters in Mr. Diaz's case, because Justice Thomas's analysis was there was the closest fit analysis, and that the Fifth Amendment has a self-exclusionary clause within it. And no other constitutional right is implicated by the Fifth Amendment. But the fact that Mr. Diaz did not consent to the search of his automobile and they use his statement as probable cause to search the automobile, now you have another constitutional right which is implicated, and that's the Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable searches and seizures, unreasonable searches. And the fact that they use the statement for probable cause, Justice Thomas's closest fit analysis does not apply in this situation, because in Patain and Bradshaw, there was consent to search. And that consent to search does not implicate Miranda, does not implicate incriminatory, because those statements are not incriminatory. Yes.
But Mr. Diaz, I mean, this is not his first situation or encounter with police. There was nothing that forced him to disclose what was in the vehicle. I mean, he could have just remained silent.
But he was questioned by the police. I think this was conceded on the trial court, that it was interrogation. It was likely to elicit an incriminatory response. And based upon their direct question, he answered it. He answered that question. And this is all after the fact that he was thrown to the ground, handcuffed, right after the fact. I don't think the issue is, you know, whether this is not something that Miranda should have required. I think the issue is that it was a statement which was inherently intimidating. He made a response to them, which was incriminatory, and then used that response as a basis to search his automobile. And because they used that, only that statement alone, not his consent to search your automobile, that's why Patain and Bradshaw really don't apply in the situation. I think there's a material factual distinction in this case compared to those cases. But even if this court says, okay, we're going to follow Patain, we're going to follow Bradshaw, you have to do a Colorado constitutional analysis in Section 18. And again, this is where it shows where the closest fit analysis is not applied. And that is because the Colorado Constitution has been essentially interpreted by the Colorado Supreme Court in Cuddle a little more broader, in that it's not just, you know, a confession against a trial, it also goes to whether there's a link in the chain of evidence to secure a conviction. And that's why now the whole Justice Thomas textual argument, you know, closest fit, doesn't apply under the Colorado Constitution. And also, if you look at the other courts that dealt with this, other states that have dealt with this under their own respective constitutions, they say it makes much better policy, you know, to essentially use the local tree analysis. Because doing otherwise, you're going to give an incentive to law enforcement to flout the rules of Miranda. And clearly, if someone says, you know, there's a violation of Miranda, which is Miranda's given for the purposes, because they understand it's inherently intimidating for a police officer to question someone, if the police knows, hey, we could get, you know, just a very, very response is, you know, there's drugs or there's something very, very, just like that, they know it doesn't make a difference that limits even drugs is being suppressed, because they know if they use that as probable cause to search something, they might find kilos of drugs somewhere else, and that statement's going to be immaterial, whether that's going to be suppressed or not.
Well, counsel, Miranda is a federal rule that is based upon, I don't know if it's interpretation of the U.S. Constitution, but it derives from the U.S. Constitution in some way, perhaps. So why should we care what a state court thinks the best way to implement Miranda is when the U.S. Supreme Court has spoken on that in Patain?
But Miranda also protects the Colorado constitutional interest, the Article Section 18. And the same reason why Miranda applies to the Fifth Amendment, it also applies to Colorado Article 2, Section 18. That's the whole point of Miranda, to show, hey, under these circumstances, is inherently intimidating. And that's why Miranda has been used for both the United States constitutional rights and also Colorado constitutional rights.
Mr. Lansky, remind me, in the motions below and arguments below, did the defendant rely also on the Colorado Constitution as distinct from the U.S. Constitution?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, let's be clear. Did he actually make an argument or simply cite it?
I think he made an argument. I'm pretty sure he made this whole argument on the Patain and why Colorado Constitution applies. Specifically saying that, you know, I think citing, I don't remember the specific case.
The old 1905 case?
No, not the 1905. I think it's the Bradshaw case. I think even they cite to it with instance of saying, hey, the link in the chain of evidence to secure a conviction. So I think it absolutely was argued on point on that issue. No, being that I have almost a minute and a half, I can reserve the rest of my time. Okay, thank you.
May I please the court? I'm Patricia Van Horn, registration number 30,002, and I represent the people. I'll address first the conflict issue. The defendant sort of frames this and relies on cases where the trial court disqualified a public defender over defense objections, where the public defense, where the trial court noticed or the prosecution noticed, there looks like there's a conflict here, and over defense objections, the trial court disqualified the public defender. And in Harlan and the other cases, the reason why this was held to be error is it said a better record needed to be developed about the nature of the conflict, whether the defendant was, whether the type of conflict that could be waived, and whether the defendant was willing to waive it. Here, in contrast, we have a situation where the public defender has come in and said, we can no longer represent the defendant, we have a conflict involving the witness, the state office has told me we have to withdraw, we have all followed all the proper procedures for withdrawal. Now, while that statement standing alone wouldn't necessarily, didn't compel the trial court wasn't required to grant the motion to withdraw based on that statement, the trial court didn't err in relying on that statement. It was sufficient for the trial court to grant the motion to withdraw. And I think what the defendant is almost saying here is he had a constitutional right to insist on having the public defender represent him, even though the public defender said, we can't because we have a conflict. And he has cited no case for that proposition that you can force an attorney who has an unwaivable conflict, which the trial court found here, to represent a defendant. So I think they're very different situations, what he's relying on as far as what kind of inquiry the trial court should have conducted, as opposed to what it did do. Does the court have any questions about that issue?
I have a question.
Yes.
As to an indigent defendant's rights to continued representation from a state-appointed attorney, what is the source of that right, in your opinion? I've seen the cases mentioned that it exists, but it's not clear to me what the source is.
I've seen cases that talk in terms of an indigent defendant doesn't have a right to insist upon a particular attorney.
Right to choose at the outset, but there's some cases that say after that, and after representation has begun, there's the defendant has some right to continued representation, which is not absolute, but there's some right. I'm just wondering, what's the basis for that right?
I don't remember what the exact source of that is. I mean, I'm sure it's just the constitutional right, the general constitutional right to counsel, but I don't recall what the exact source of that, but I've seen those cases that talk about those rights, counsel of choice. I'll move on then to the suppression question. The defendant doesn't cite anything, and I couldn't find anything, standing for the proposition that Colorado Constitution would provide a greater remedy for a Fifth Amendment violation than the U.S. Constitution provides. It seems in all the cases I read that we pretty much follow how the U.S. Constitution.
Is this a Fifth Amendment or Fourth Amendment?
It's the remedy for a Fifth Amendment violation. And I haven't found any cases, he doesn't cite to any, that Colorado would treat these differently at all.
Did you find it? Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Did you find any cases in which the state Supreme Court or this court has said that the Miranda warnings are necessary to protect Colorado constitutional rights?
I didn't really look at that issue carefully. I was just looking for when we're looking at, we're doing the comparisons and when we deviate from the U.S. Constitution, because we do. We've provided greater protection in areas like involving free expression and that sort of thing. But I couldn't find one where we've crafted a different remedy for a Fifth Amendment violation at all. And just given the way these have been analyzed, and we seem to have followed how the U.S. Supreme Court has handled these issues, I assume that this court would also view the Colorado Constitution the same way.
Thank you.
Counsel, what about Mr. Lansky's point that in this case, unlike in Patain and Bradshaw, we don't have consent to the search by the defendant?
I didn't, the way I've read those cases and the cases interpreting those cases, I don't think it turns on that particular fact that there was consent at all.
What do they turn on?
They just turn on if the statement that the statement gave probable cause to search, that's sufficient, unless the statement was involuntarily made. If it was a voluntary statement, even though it was in violation of Miranda, that's good enough. But I haven't seen any Colorado cases that draw that distinction and say, well, in this case it... And the trial court here is going by what it has, which is Pantane and the Goslin case. And so I haven't seen a case that made that distinction, or that was brought out to the trial court and some argument was made, and the trial court was shown cases that made that distinction. That should lead the trial court to believe that Goslin and Pantane don't apply in these circumstances.
Counsel, before we get too deep into the time here, I want to make sure I cover an issue, and that's the self-defense instruction that was denied here. As I understand the facts of the second incident, cars are traveling in different directions, the driver sticks his head out of the car and does a U-turn, and at that point the defendant fires toward the car. Now, while those facts by themselves might not lend themselves to a self-defense instruction, don't we have to consider what had allegedly happened, and it coming to evidence is happening the week before in a very similar incident involving the defendant?
There was no evidence that he had reasonable grounds to believe that the occupants of that SUV presented an imminent danger to him. According to him, they're traveling in opposite directions. All he sees is someone stick their head out of the car. He says he thought they were turning around, and so he fired warning shots at them to scare them away. And I just don't think that's not evidence of reasonable grounds to believe he faces imminent harm when he's speeding off in this direction and they're driving in this direction.
Even if previous week he's been shot at in a similar incident?
Correct. I don't believe that's reasonable grounds. And the Supreme Court said in Speer that when there are, and I apologize because I realized when I was reading my brief I didn't do a pinpoint cite on this, but 255 P3rd at 1120. And they said that we've noticed in a variety of settings that it's proper for a court to deny an instruction on one of these related defenses, and Speer involves a duress defense, when there's evidence of undisputed reasonable legal alternatives. And one of the couple of cases they cite in that portion of Speer involved self-defense instruction. And there were, he could have just kept driving. He could have kept driving, called someone. That's all he had to do. He didn't have to fire warning shots at a car just because he thought somebody gave him a dirty look. He didn't say that he saw the occupants of the car, recognized them, or saw them with a gun or anything like that. He said one of the occupants appeared to be mad-dogging him, appeared to be staring at him. And I don't think those are reasonable grounds to believe that you face imminent physical force being used against you.
Didn't he also say that he saw the car turning around?
He said he thought he saw the car... that he thought he saw the car getting ready to turn around. That's what he said. But at that point, of course, it's going to take some time for a car to turn around. He's already going this way.
But he's not going to outrun a bullet, no matter how fast he drives.
So they're still turning around. He had the opportunity to perform some evasive action, to speed up, to go down the side street. He did have a reasonable alternative.
And just but isn't that for the jury to ultimately determine whether or not it accepts the defense? I mean, it's a pretty low standard. I mean, if there's any kind of evidence to suggest the propriety of giving the instruction, the trial court should give the instruction, and then let both counsel argue about whether or not the evidence supports the defense.
But the grounds have to be reasonable, and I just don't think these are reasonable grounds in this situation when you see someone staring at you, and that's all you see is somebody giving you what you perceive to be a dirty look. For you to be able to speculate as people out to kill me, oh, and I see them turning, so I think they're turning around, and so I'll fire warning shots. And according to him, of course, he wasn't even using physical force against them. He was merely warning them away by firing this gun. So I don't, I think the trial court properly denied it. There just wasn't enough here to satisfy the elements of the defense. If this court has no further questions, I'd ask that the conviction and sentence be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel.
Just to respond to Judge Navarro's question, as People v. Isham, which is defendant has a right to continued counsel with appointed counsel, who's a court of appeals case.
Right. What was the source of the right?
I think it's budgets on it's the choice of counsel, right? The Sixth Amendment. And I'm saying if the defendant has a right to choose counsel based upon the Sixth Amendment.
Right, but I thought this is in the context of an indigent defendant who does not have a Sixth Amendment right to choose his counsel at the outset.
Right.
But somehow he developed this right after representation begins. How does that happen?
I think once counsel is appointed, I think an attorney-client relationship is formed. And because of that formation, then the defendant has a continued right to continue with that relationship, with that representation. I think what People v. Isham does is they base that on the Sixth Amendment choice of counsel right. Just because he's indigent doesn't mean he has less rights than someone who can afford to buy counsel to represent him.
Thank you.
Just very briefly, with regards to. The state's arguments as to, well, in those cases cited by Moselino and Harlan, those are cases where either the court or the prosecutor made the motion to disqualify counsel. I believe that's a consequence, that's a distinction without any consequence. I think the rules apply regardless of who raises the disqualification motion. I think the Supreme Court sets a procedure through Harlan and Moselino. And they didn't make any distinction whether who brings up this qualification motion or not. With that, I'm out of time, and I respectfully ask the court to reverse my client's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course.